gig operation. The gunplexes, which were a lot looser than a DRO, I understand that. The gunplexes in the early days of 10 gigs gave you a lot of performance for the money. However, from my point of view, having been on 10 gigs for a fraction of more than a decade, I've come to the conclusion that the progressive guys and 95% of the guys are now on true narrowband operation. That means they start off with a seventh overtone crystal at 100 megacycles, which is that part of a brick oscillator assembly. And if it's working correctly with this oven, you can guarantee your frequency to the nearest couple of kilohertz. And if you discipline that oscillator with a global positioning satellite receiver system or something similar, you can have or use a rubidium standard or a cesium standard. You can have your frequency accuracy on 10 gigs to the nearest 1 hertz. The really serious guys that are doing DX, they want to have better than 1 kilohertz of frequency accuracy and 1 hertz of accuracy if they can get it. And the DRO, as a function of temperature and voltage you supply to and whatever, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to make a guess. It could easily be 150 kilohertz wrong, and therefore doesn't really fall into the category of narrowband operation, which is the most popular kind of single sideband and occasionally Morse code operation on 10 gigs today. Now, a smart guy like you, Joe, I'm pretty sure could find a way of disciplining the DRO to get the frequency accuracy exactly what he wants. Guarantee a smart guy could do that. But now we're getting a little bit more elaborate. Maybe I'm going off on a tangent here, but I'm a little bit worried about narrowband versus so-called wideband operation. And maybe you've got more information on who has done it and which one of those modes were they using it on. Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, WJ2B. I didn't mean to suggest to use the Hot Wheels gun as a basis for a narrowband system. I was meaning to make it into a wideband FM modulated, walkie-talkie type of setup that you could put somewhere onto the ham band and use it as an HT, just as an experiment. But you could probably use the DRO that's in there. You could probably use it as part of a loop, use that as a voltage-controlled oscillator somehow and make it into a voltage-controlled oscillator that is, resonant at whatever frequency the puck is set up at. And I think there's even an adjustment. There's a cavity in here with a very small screwdriver adjustment to change the sensor frequency. So if you were able to swing that with a voltage and make it part of a phase-like loop, you could probably use it to even to make a narrow-banded system, with a lot of external circuitry. But what I was thinking was just making it into a, an FM, FM it somehow with a little audio amp with a mic, and then somehow set up a receiver and use it as, I don't know if you can use the receiver section, that's the only problem, but, some kind of receiver and make it into a 10 gigahertz walkie-talkie. That might be an interesting project, being that you can start off with a little $30 thing here. But the power on it is very, very, very low. It'll only pick up a car about between 100 and 200 feet away. So it doesn't have much power output as far as the. There probably is a way to increase the power output, but it's an interesting little system they set up there for under $30. And there's pictures on the internet of it all taken apart and the DRO oscillator taken apart. And quite an interesting setup for the amount of money that you can spend for it. But, I guess people play with those police radars too to fool around with 10 gigahertz stuff to the old X-band police radars. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's worth doing as a project or not. But for narrow bands, it's definitely would need a lot of external stuff. If that could be you, the BJ, you think?
Oh, as a worthwhile project, I don't mean to discourage you, Joe. I think it's definitely a worthwhile project. And when you think the power output is very low because it only can pick up the car at 100 or 200 feet, whoa! A radar that has 100 or 200 feet of range and it's got a simple crystal diode front end, which is what I think the receiver has got, I think we're talking about 50 to 150 milliwatts of output here. I talked to people on 10 states, all on single sideband eventually, on 10 gigahertz. I did that with a 2-foot dish on 100 feet of tower, and 200 milliwatts of power. I've never run to date more than 200 milliwatts. I talked to people in 10 states on that band, and best distance is 380 miles down to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. So when it comes to the word low power, it's got an entirely different meaning, and QRP, it's got an entirely different set of meanings when it comes to 10 gig. You're getting a 34 dB of gain out of the dish that you transmit with. So a fraction of a watt can become a close to a kilowatt of effective radiated power, as long as you know which way to aim the thing, because it's got a 3-degree beamwidth. And the guy tends to set up the contacts by making a 2-meter QSO on 144.260 sideband. You get on there and say, hey, this is the 10 gig contest. I'm looking for people to talk to. Is anybody around? And somebody comes back to you on 144.260 and says, yes, I'm located in Wisconsin. I'm in Fox November 30 kilowatt uniform. Please aim your antenna in my direction, and we'll make a QSO out of it. On top of that, Joe, you live in Wisconsin. The president of the Long Island main group for a lot of years that's on 10 gigs, the 10X group, is Bruce, and Thrill ID, who lives in your town, probably not very many blocks from you. So the next time you see Bruce eye to eye, mention this piece of equipment to him. I certainly will. And by the way, when it comes to the people who do 10 gigs and similar operation, this coming, that was yesterday. We already missed it. There was a meeting of the news group, Northeast Weak Signal Society, up at Enfield, Connecticut. Yesterday, Saturday, there was a meeting. Bruce was going to go, and if I hadn't mixed up the date, I would have been telling you about it. I didn't have the option to go. I had something else I had to do, but I know that Andy, the A2CDL, went to one of those meetings, was extremely enthusiastic about it, and says, yeah, I want to get into this jazz. So I think you got a good tiger by the tail there, Joe. Let me pass it back to you for any further comments. WJ2B, J2LIW.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I've been working at a company that does microwave converters, down converters, amplifiers, and it's a real interesting field. I hope to get more involved with some projects. But it struck me that this gun, you know, was a possibility, because being that the DRO is adjustable and it's at the sticker on the bottom says 10.525, so we're talking about the high. I think the ham band is 10 to 10.5, so it's right at the edge of the ham band. You could probably tune the DRO a little bit, get it inside the ham band, but of course you need a frequency counter that's that can go up that high, which most people wouldn't have. That's kind of expensive equipment to be able to make any measurements at those frequencies. So unless you have access to that kind of stuff at work, most people, I guess, really wouldn't have the equipment to do it. But it's an interesting field. The place I'm working at goes up to, I've seen stuff that they have up to, probably is up to 300 gigahertz. I think they've gone as high as that they go. And most of the stuff is in the lower ranges, anywhere from 7 to 40 gig. And it's real interesting stuff. It's really amazing what they can do with those components that those people see. Gets to the point where you need a microscope to see. Otherwise, you can't even see what you're doing there. But, so it's quite a field. There's so many satellites up there. Everybody needs equipment to talk to the satellites. So it's quite a big industry there. There's quite a few. I guess there's quite a few companies on Long Island that make microwave equipment. So. Anyway, okay, Dick, it was good talking to you. We'll be listening to
WJ2B. When you talked about those frequencies, you've got my interest, Joe, and it's your choice. Are you allowed to tell me what company we're talking about here?
I think I spoke with you about it once before. I'd rather keep it off the air, but next time I see you in person, we could discuss it more.
Okay, thank you. And do try to remember to remind me as to which company it is. I've got a couple of guesses, but I'm not sure. And it takes a fairly progressive company to be working at those frequencies. Also, don't let a person become discouraged about getting on 10 gigs because he doesn't have the right test equipment. All you need is for one guy of the group to have the right test equipment. The 10X group on Long Island, when we were really active a few years ago, 10X and 10 gigahertz and X-band, that's how we chose the name 10X. It's a takeoff on the word 9X, which is a popular cell phone business at the time. Bruce has the counter that goes to beyond 10 gigs. He's got the network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, frequency counter, power meter, and so on, power supply. So all you have to do is meet over Bruce's house, line up your equipment, and you're on the air. So everybody doesn't have to have test equipment on these frequencies to get there. What you need is for one guy in the group to have each one of those pieces of test equipment and get together periodically, and you got it made. Okay, now it's time for the space report. Hey, Paul, what have those guys been doing out there? What are they planning on next? And I think most of us have known that there was an extremely good program on PBS last week about the Cassini and Huygens mission that went to Saturn. Very nicely done. NOVA program. And even if you missed it, maybe you'll catch it again and see it and record it. Find somebody who's got a recording of it and get a copy. Or you can also go to the PBS website and watch that program. Rather well done, and boy, I enjoyed it a lot. Told you an awful lot about the hardware that went out there. 2 billion mile trip out to Saturn, and it's making some eye-opening measurements about the second body in this solar system that we believe is capable of life, the moon Titan, which goes around Saturn, which has a whole lot of methane-like products. So it's in the early stage of forming life possibilities, as I see it. WS2N. You got it, Paul. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I like all those deep space missions. Got another one going, that New Horizon out of Pluto. What is that? I think that's 2015, I think, or something. So these things go a long time, for many, many years, and then they have to hope that when they turn it back on. I like that part in that movie with a guy, in that documentary with a guy said, you know, it's like having a car for 7 years. And, you know, you hope you're going to turn the key in case of an emergency. You hope this thing starts, you know. It's been sitting idle for so long. So, yeah, but, you know, that was a good show. Well, the space station crew has got the Harmony node bolted back up to the International Space Station. That was temporarily stored, and that's completed. That was put into a temporary location, and when the shuttle was there, and then when they left, it was up to the space station crew to put it into the same port where the shuttle had left from. So now it's extended. They have to put the pressure mating adapter back on the end of the node. Then the shuttle will be able to redock with that. And those who don't know, that node was about 23 feet long, about 15 feet in diameter, weighed about 30,000 pounds. So it's another gigantic room, but it's essentially an interconnecting Lego type of arrangement where you want to hook up different components, like Columbus going up there at the end of the year on Discovery. On December 6th, to be bolted to that particular node, will give them another gigantic lab, or lab built by the European Space Agency. I think I want to go over a couple of things in the future, because there's not much going on right now until the next shuttle flight. Deep space probes are still on their way to wherever they're going. Cassini's still returning information from Saturn. But a couple of things about the up-and-coming Constellation program. That's the next stage after the space shuttle. Space shuttle being retired in 2010. We're now going to have the Constellation program, which consists of really two separate boosters. They're both called Ares. There's an Ares 1 and an Ares 5 boost system. And Ares 5 will lift heavy cargo into space to to dock with astronauts, for instance, on a trip to the moon, you launch on a big, heavy cargo Ares 5 rocket. The equipment, the final stage can get you to the moon, plus the lunar lander, that type of thing. If you launch on this Ares 5 setup, which consists of five engines, like J2 engines, similar to the shuttle engines. They'll be using a tank also similar to the external tank on the shuttle. And then on top, next to this whole setup, you'll have two booster rockets, and those are similar, almost the same type of booster rockets that you have now attached to the shuttle. And on top of that whole thing, you would have your payload that would go into space. You still have another stage, a final J2X rocket, similar to the design of the Saturn V rocket that put that thing into space. You have liquid hydrogen, liquid hydrogen running that. They call it the J2X, and that'll be the second stage. And on top of that, you'll have your payload. But to get the men in this space, what you're going to have is you're going to have your solid booster rocket, and that's pretty much it, your main stage, first stage. On top of that, you'll have a second stage, another one of these J2 rockets, designed J2X. They call the rocket on the Apollo the J2. They call it the J2X. So an updated version of that second stage will then put the crew into space, and the crew is going to be mounted in the payload, which is called the Orion spacecraft. Up to six astronauts that could be on board. Let's say when visiting the International Space Station, you would put four on board if you go to the moon, for instance. But six on a regular basis to the space station. They are building hardware. I mean, they just finished a mock-up version of the Orion spacecraft. They also just tested a parachute for returning the solid boosters back to, the solid boosters are going to be reused, similar to what they do on a space shuttle. They have this big parachute now that they've just tested for the second time. It worked perfectly. Just to give you an idea, the parachute itself weighs 1 ton, 2,000 pounds, and it had a 40,000-pound payload attached to it. They brought it up on a Air Force C-17 plane and dropped it 3 miles high, and it worked fine. So they're doing things. They've got the parachute system down, mock-up version of the Orion spacecraft. A lot of the rockets that are going to be developed are spin-offs of everything that we do have, either from the Saturn V rockets or from the shuttle system. And the Orion spacecraft, when that gets up there, it's going to kind of look like the Apollo, but much bigger. So it's going to have these big solar panels that are going to come out for supplying energy for it. And these solar panels, they're kind of like round. They're round-looking when you look at them. And there'll be two of them sticking out of the sides of the spacecraft. The diameter of the solar panels are about the same diameter as the spacecraft itself, roughly about 18, 20 feet in diameter. So, thought I'd mention that. One interesting part, they're even coming up with ideas about after you get to the moon. They want to set up a base. They already know where they want to go, down near the South Pole. One particular crater called the Shackleton Crater. They'd like to set up a regular moon base there. You'll have, let's say, four astronauts going to the moon in the Orion spacecraft. They'll separate from the Orion spacecraft and in the lander, and all four will land, and the Orion spacecraft will continue around in orbit, unmanned, different from the Apollo days. When you sent three astronauts there, you would have two on the moon, and one guy, you know, Michael Collins, let's say, for Apollo 11, be flying around for days, you know, for a couple of days, or in some cases, 3 or 4 days for the later missions, all by himself. Well, that's not going to happen anymore. You're going to have the mothership, the Orion spacecraft, in orbit, and all four people will be on the surface and creating a base, and maybe for weeks or even months at a time on the surface of the moon. One interesting thing that they made, well, they showed a couple of designs I've seen of the rovers that are going to be riding around. They have one rover where you'll have like two astronauts standing as the thing rolls along the surface. That's one design. But another interesting design, which I really liked, was they have this pressurized rover. So now you're in this rover, short-sleeve environment, different from the old rovers where you had the astronaut inside the lens, putting on a spacesuit, getting out, getting into the rover, two of them riding around in a spacesuit, and they'd have to come back. This, you would leave from the moon base for a hatch, short sleeve environment, get into this pressurized rover, and you're inside like a little lab. You'll be able to ride around. Now, attached to the outside of this little lab, this roving lab, on the sides, they have the spacesuit attached to the unit itself on the outside of the craft. So let's say if you wanted to go for a spacewalk, you're in your regular clothes, all you do is open up the back of the spacesuit and climb into it. As you climb into it, you're already outside because the spacesuit is outside. Close the door behind you, or the little back of your space suit. You have a little ladder there, go down onto the moon, walk around. I thought that was pretty neat. I definitely hope you take that design, because that's pretty good. It eliminates a lot of problems. One of the biggest problems is to come back to 11, it'd be full of dirt, soot, and everything from the moon, and they were worried about this stuff fogging up system, getting all over the place, breathing it, and everything. Now, with this, everything stays outdoors. I thought it was pretty neat. So they're working on things. It's a ways away. First launch to the International Space Station by a manned crew will be, it looks like 2014 is the predicted date. Back to the moon, we got a ways away, maybe 2019, 2020. But interesting anyway. K2RIWWS2S, back to that.
W2EL, repeater system.
While we're waiting for this to get back into the NGNB, I got a question for you. Where are you getting all the information from? Because I can't seem to find it.
Oh, okay, Barry. For this particular topic, I mean, this one, about the spacesuit, that design, that did come from the internet, from NASA.gov. Just find that there. But all these other topics, I think I've gone over the crew exploration vehicle, the Orion, they call it. I've gone over that before, so I still have that here from my notes months ago. Probably the same with the Ares launch vehicles. The name of the Constellation was chosen, oh, I guess, what, 6, 7 months ago for the whole system. Parachute was on the NASA.gov as well. That recently, Barry, back there.
Okay, I got to look at NASA.gov a little more. I did. It used to, but maybe I haven't been doing it. Okay, real good. I think it's probably coming back on the way. Probably going to kill the AMD.
Inquiry's there. Have Spirit and Opportunity done anything worth talking about recently? I presume their mission has been extended and they're still funded for observing what they're doing. Is that true?
Yeah, they'll never give up funding that now. You know, there's two vehicles on there. How many billions of dollars did it cost to get there? And they're already there, so yeah. As long as the batteries don't quit, the wheels keep going, the motors keep going, that'll go on forever. There, you got Spirit still up in the Columbia Hills, they call it. Roman knows the hills up there. You've got Opportunity going into that other gigantic crater. Is that Endurance crater? Oh, I don't know. Victoria crater. So that last I heard, that was going down into the crater, and that's not going to come up probably for my guess of the year. I think they're going to do complete investigation of that crater, because there's a possibility that thing might not get out, but that's the gamble they're taking.
The rock abrasion tool, the RAT, I think was partially damaged, but that's still somewhat functional. Is that true?
Both rats were working. The only thing I heard about that was the motor on one of those was not right. They have to keep it in an upright position when they move Opportunity around. I didn't hear that the rat was worn out or anything. I'll have to check on that one. If that's what you heard, I guess that's a possibility. You know, they've been using that thing every time you turn around on both vehicles. So it could be. It looks like a big drill. That is an interesting arm. You know, you turn it one way, you've got a drill. You turn it another way, you've got a camera. You turn it another way, you just read the minerals within the rock. You just rotate on the end. You get these different capabilities. So I'm surprised none of these. Every motor pretty much keeps going. You got the one right wheel on Spirit that's not right. It's dragging that thing backwards for years now, seems like. So, but they keep on going. I mean, they're really energized the buttons up there.
And now my last question is, I think the definition of success is if the two spacecraft lasted, or the remote probes, whatever you want to call them, the two roving cars, Spirit and Opportunity on Mars, if they lasted for 3 months, and I think we're now at roughly 3.5 or 3.75 years of life. Is that approximately right, Paul?
I think January 3rd, 2004, and January 14th, the 14th, or the 20-something. But a couple of weeks, two or three weeks later, the other one landed, first Spirit and then Opportunity. So coming up to the fourth year anniversary this January.
I bet you there'll be another Nova on that. There was a very good Nova about those two spacecraft. Okay, fun stuff. I wonder if you received any mail this week, Mel. I say that sheepishly. Mel, did you receive any mail? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, roger. It says K2KEY. I didn't even look at it, to tell you the truth. Yes, I'll take a peek here. I want to get to it now. Let's cover everything else, everybody. Stop digging out the mail here. Oh, I get plenty of mail and all. That's not the problem. Can I answer everybody? That's another problem. So I'll just go down the list and see if we can catch up on some of it, Dick. Are we ready for it now?
I am for you, Dick.
Let's find out if we... I've gone down the whole list of everyone who signed in. Now, Rich, go ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, I don't want to take too much time, but I want to revisit that loop antenna. What you guys think for vertical loops, in other words, full wave, quad loops, north side, east and west, on 75 meters.
A pure vertical half-wave dipole mounted at a reasonable altitude, in my opinion, is going to give a lot of performance. If you make a vertically polarized loop antenna, I'm having trouble believing the performance will be any bigger. Because once a vertical half-wave dipole is at resonance, giving you full effective capture area, which is 0.13 lambda squared, that's the effective capture area of a half-wave dipole when it's resonated. In the case of 80 meters, that's around 8,500 square feet of effective capture area. A full-wave loop instead of a half-wave loop, I think the effective capture area is going to be almost identical. And so the next question is all the effort worth it? Well, I don't know of anyone who has done it. And since Barry's got this aero motor tower where you could mount it on, and I know he was making a kind of a phased array on HF frequencies some time ago, it would be an interesting experiment to see if it does perform better. I'm not convinced it will. I think Mel's on the right track where he's using a tenth of a wavelength loop, but he's got full capability to steer it as L and polarization. That adaptability to the variable characteristics of the ionosphere is, in my opinion, very valuable. And that vertical loop, full wave, would you be able to reorient it? Well, I can think of ways with ropes and pulleys in which you could do it. So before I completely discourage you on that one, let me find out from you and Barry, so to speak, what you believe might be the increase in performance. Because you got to be careful now you don't fall into a trap. Just because what you see as an antenna to your eye looks like it's bigger and occupies more area does not necessarily mean that electronically it occupies more area, more effective capture area. The magic of resonance is that a very simple piece of wire becomes a great big fat cucumber in space as far as its effective capture area is concerned. N2EO, K2RIW.
Well, basically, it would be a similar to a quad, single element quad loop, which has about 2.5 dB of gain. It's going to be a triangular, not a square loop, but a triangle, fed at the top. And I'm going to come up a little short on real estate to make a full range on 80, and Barry suggested that I make up real estate I don't have in a stub, a closed stub made out of wine. I wonder what you and Mel think about that. You know, I'll see the improvement of looking for a TX antenna as opposed to what I've got now, which is a halfway inverted
C. Okay. I'm not sure. I'm going to pass it over to Mel and see if he thinks it'll have more performance. There are people who put up diamond-like antennas and in triangle vertically polarized loop who are quite happy with them. But did they get a chance to really compare it to a half-wave vertical dipole, which is a rare antenna? And I don't think it should be rare. If a person's got enough altitude of a tree or tower or whatever to do it, I think you should try it. A vertical half-wave dipole could be an excellent antenna. And could be simpler than the triangle you're talking about, a cubical quad. When you set it as quad at 2.5 dB of gain, if you said 2.5 dB over isotropic, then it would be identical almost to a dipole. If you're saying 2.5 dB over a dipole, now that's significant. So when you said 2.5 dB of gain, what was the point of reference there, Rich? Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick, as I recall, in Bill Orr's quad handbook years ago, a single element of a quad is about 2.5 dB over a dipole, if I'm correct.
Okay. I wonder, I'm going to have to go look back to Bill Orr's handbook. I probably have a copy of it. I'm going to check that out. Let's see what Mel thinks about your vertical loop or quad as opposed to a vertical dipole. Now, none of us have built a vertical dipole, to my knowledge, so therefore we don't have hands-on experience of doing it. So, Mel's built enough 80-meter pieces of wire up in the air, so maybe from that experience he's got a good opinion. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, Dick, I almost have a vertical dipole, but I'm using for that.
Yeah, you were building a kind of a phased array thing, Barry. Let me stand by for a second here, Mel. Barry, how are you doing with that? And is that project on hold because of the weather, or are you still going forward on that one?
Okay, that project is not on hold. I will be pressing on with that project in the next few months. It was on hold because I wasn't in the best health last month, but getting better, and I intend to get back to this project very soon. In fact, I'm starting to gather parts again for it. What I'm doing now is, you probably all know, I've got a inverted beam, but it's vertically polarized, so it's about 75 feet tall, and it's working beautifully. I compare that to a horizontal dipole antenna. I can throw a switch here and go back and forth, and I can tell you that when it comes to working stations about 3,000 or 4,000 miles out, like Europe or Asia or Russia, those directions, it is a real performer. It's beautiful. When it comes to working stations in the United States, it always works. But what I'm putting it up for is to work in the DX station, so I'm very happy with it.
Okay, now, do you have some directionality to that? Can you tune it to the east and west by making changes to that antenna, or has it not gotten to that quite capability yet? So you're the first guy, I guess, in the neighborhood who has really built a vertical half-wave dipole. The fact that it's an inverted V versus a real dipole, I think it's a matter of mechanical construction. Electronically, I think the performance is going to be quite similar. So when it comes to you comparing a horizontal dipole to your vertical dipole, give me a rough guess. Is a vertical dipole quite often and a full S unit stronger on reception or transmission? Back to you, Barry. And Barry, you could use quite a bit more audio. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, I'm always scrolling around here. I will get to the audio thing later. It's difficult for me to adjust it. As far as performance goes, it's usually a good S unit stronger, both, of course, receiving and transmitting. Everybody tells them that. I can't tell you how many times I've worked stations in Europe, and when I switch from one to the other, it means I can hear them and work them beautifully on the vertical, I'll call it a vertical, and I can barely understand them on the horizontal. And this is over and over again. I'm so impressed with that that's the reason why I'm going to go ahead constructing the second element of this thing and get some direction out of it. A lot of people have told me, and I don't totally agree. They say, well, right now, you look at it, you picture it as an arrow, whatever, pointed towards Europe. They tell me that that would be like northeast. They tell me that towards the south, the antenna looks more like a horizontal antenna. I don't agree with that. I think it's more like an oblique. I don't think it's horizontal. I think it's 45 degrees is the way it would be pictured. When I go to the second element, that's not going to matter because that's going to be a very null direction in any way. So it's going to be a good antenna. So far, I'm very happy with it, and I recommend it highly. Even if you can't put up two of them, like I plan on doing in the next few months, if you could put up one, I think it's a DX antenna, it's a real winner.
Yeah, the guys calling it horizontal, I think, are being unfair. My gut feel, Barry, is that that is a vertically polarized antenna, no matter what angle you look at it from. The fact that it's not completely straight, the fact that it's bent, doesn't matter very much, very, very minor. So a full ES unit better. And I'm just sitting here realizing I've got the real estate to do that. I've got a tower tall enough. I could mount that thing at a nice altitude off the ground. In your particular case, the bottom of the inverted V comes how close to the ground battery? That's question number one. And question number two, the original article from which you built this, if you happen to know the reference, what month of what magazine or what website, please let me know. N2 Moonbound, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, I don't have the information in front of me, but I surely can get it for you because it's somehow embedded in one of my computers. So maybe while we're talking, if we have enough time, I'll get back to you and find you that article. It's actually a kind of a reference more than an article, and the guy that did it, somebody else did it, and he was very happy with it, so he sort of put it in as a suggestion, and a number of people have said not to do it another way. The other way would be to have the two verticals coming off of the tower as if they were guy wires, you know, one this way and one that way, all the way down to the ground, instead of inverted beating them back to the bottom of the tower. A number of people have told me that doesn't work well at all. So I'm going to go by their suggestion. They don't like it, and I don't even want to try.
But if it was like a guy wire all the way down to the ground, wouldn't it be a sloper? And there's a fair number of people who really love a sloper. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, but not as a two-element beam. See, my plan is to use this thing as a two-element array, kind of a phase thing. You know what I'm going to do, and make this thing unidirectional, pretty much, either northeast or southwest. And then with a little switching around, I'll make it, it'll have a little bit of gain in the other two directions, but it won't be unidirectional. It'll be bidirectional in the other way.
Are you thinking about making this a vertical dipole arrow-like thing every 120 degrees or every 90 degrees? Is it going to be a three-sided or a four-sided thing with its electronic steering capability? Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, I gave that a lot of thought, and I decided I'm only going to have two directions. I'm not going to have four of them. I'm only going to have two of them. So in two directions, I'm going to have a beam-like pattern, unidirectional, and in two directions I'm going to have like a big figure eight, that kind of thing.
And with your arrow inverted V vertically polarized, do you feed it by bringing a ladder line at right angles off of the apex straight over to the tower, or have you figured out an arrangement where by which you feed it from the bottom? Back to you, Barry.
No, I don't want to feed it from the bottom. I'm going to feed the point of the arrow with coax. I'm not using ladder line. I decided against it. A lot of problems with ladder line trying to do that, and it's just easier to use a ballon or a choke or something and coax. So that's the approach I'm going to take.
And the coax will be coming out from the tower roughly how far, and will there be any kind of intermediate support for that coax?
No, don't need it. It's just going to hang from the, it's going to come back to the tower, which is about 45 or something feet. And then I'm not going to put my, I'm going to have like a quarter wave sub or something like that, to make this thing unidirectional from one to the other. In other words, I'm going to make it a quarter wave longer in one direction. Or less. So the reason why I haven't decided that is because I never really was able to figure out exactly what that lens ought to be. So instead of putting that hardware outside, I'm bringing two coax lines all the way into the shack, and I'm going to put my switch and my jumper in the shack, and then I can play around with this thing. I can add length to it and, really kind of fine-tune it.
Okay, now, I'll admit it's much more difficult impedance-wise to feed it at the bottom, but electronically, I believe the performance should be identical. You have chosen not to feed it from the bottom. For what reason?
How will I make the counterpoint? In other words, I have this, going to feed the coax. So what am I going to do with it? I'm going to attach the other piece of coax to a ground post or something? It's just difficult to do that. I want to have a regular dipole, so I don't have to worry about radials or anything else.
The bottom of the inverted V is how many feet off the ground, Barry?
About 1 or 2, very close to the ground. It could be right at the ground if I wanted to be.
Okay, the very good news, about a half-wave vertical radiator, is that you're feeding it at a point where the impedance is thousands of ohms. Therefore, the guys who feed a half-wave radiator from, say, for instance, the balcony of their apartment building, and the counterpoise is nothing but the metal railing that's there. In your case, one simple wire going down to a grounding post would be a beautiful counterpoise when it's a 1,000-ohm impedance. So I'm convinced you could feed it from the bottom, and if I elect to build one of these, I am going to feed it from the bottom. And once you feed it from the bottom, you can electronically easily make it longer or shorter, and therefore decide whether or not it transmits to the northeast or to the southwest by making an impedance matching network there that is or isn't connected to a transmitter. The driven element will be connected to an impedance matching network that goes to the transmitter. The parasitic element will be connected to an impedance matching network that makes it look like an inductor or a capacitor, electronically making it shorter or longer. And as I said, director or reflector. And so therefore it could be a Yagi to the northeast or a Yagi to the southwest, even though you're always feeding the same element. Let me think about that. No, I take that back. But still, I think you see where I'm going. I'm convinced that the energy bouncing back and forth on the dipole is the resonant energy, the high Q energy, it's the flywheel. And whether you supply that energy in the center, which mechanically is a little bit more difficult, or from the bottom, I think the performance is going to be essentially identical, unless I misunderstand the operation of this antenna. Back to you for any comments on that, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay. That's interesting. That little flip there. It's like I'm taking over your antenna system. If I do it that way, the way you just suggested, I would probably have to do it with open wire line, I assume. I wanted to do this with coax, and that would be a lot easier if I fed this thing with a sender. That's kind of why I'm siding in that way. That gives me the ability to, as they say, run these coax lines any length they could be. They don't have to be. As long as they're the same length, I just bring them in the house, and then by having one leading or lagging by whatever number I decide, I could sort of turn this into a nicely directional antenna. So I think it's a little more predictable the way I want to do it. And maybe run, maybe not. You know something? I really hope you do this, because I would like to see what kind of results you get versus what kind of results I get.
Barry, I've got the real estate to do this. I've got the tower to do this. In my case, I've got a little bit more altitude to work with. Therefore, I can bring the bottom of the half-wave inverted V back to the tower. I'm going to feed it with coax from the bottom. Even though I know the antenna end fed is going to be 2,000 ohms, I'll make a simple impedance step-up device right there. So my counterpoise will be the tower leg itself. The center conductor will go to maybe just a simple coil that's an impedance step-up with the turns ratio such that the 50 ohms of input becomes 2,000 ohms of output with a small amount of resonance there if need be. And I'm going to feed it the bottom of the half-wave dipole from the bottom, and I'm going to mount this whole thing as high as I can go on my particular structure. And my counterpoise will be the tower. And because I'm feeding it at the very high impedance point, it doesn't require a bunch of ground plane radials. I think you see where I'm going here. And it's going to look like the line that pulls it out to one side doesn't have to be very far away from a guy wire. By the way, in your case, in my case, the tower is in the middle of this Yagi-like structure. Don't worry about the presence of the tower. As long as the tower isn't resonant at the frequency, it is transparent, it's not there. It's a 3% blockage of the effective capture area. The other 97% is still there. I think you see the picture. Back to you, Barry.
Yes, I certainly do. And I did toy with the idea that you just brought up, using the tower as the ground point. You said, now, are you going to feed this with open wireline or coax? I missed that when you said it.
Coax. I'm a coax man. I've never used open wireline. I'm not going to start now. I will admit that the people who do get a very low loss impedance line, and particularly when they're running extremely high VisWire antennas and doing the antenna tuning in the house, it's the right way. But I'm going to run coax out to the base of the tower. I'm going to run it up the base of the up the leg of the tower to the right altitude. Then it's going to the coax is going to join some kind of a impedance matching network that steps up the 50 ohms to, let's say, 2,000. The 2,000 will be using the tower leg as the counterpoise, and the top of the 2,000 ohms will go to the bottom of this inverted V-dipole. So I'm going to be feeding it with coax, and right now I'm trying to decide, am I going to do it in three directions or four? And I've got to miss my guy wires, but I don't worry. The guy wires are not resonant. They're not there. Even if I had to go parallel to a guy wire, big deal. N2MB, KQLIW.
Okay, well, in your case, I highly recommend four. You might as well go for four. And you know, if you think about this, you could actually use this as guy wires to your tower. But, you know, that's a little... That's for another day. But as long as you put the insulator in the right place, why not? You know? Okay, I would like to, at a later date, discuss with you how you're going to make those transformers. I don't know if I'm going to do what you're doing, but I certainly am going to think about it very seriously, and maybe I'll go that route. It might be simpler. I don't know. I'm not sure. Back over to you, KQRIW and 2MB, and the group.
Hey, Barry. You and I have often seen the base of a 2-meter, 5/8 wave ground plane mag mount. If you've ever taken one of those apart, that is the impedance matching network. The 5/8 wave is just a skosh longer than half wave, but it again is working at a 2,000 ohm, and that little coil that you see in the bottom where you your coax goes in and it taps one turn and four turns up at the beginning of the connection to the actual whip itself. So the base of a 5/8 wave is electronically very close to what we're talking about. I bet you've taken one of those apart. I bet you've seen it. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't seen it came apart. I didn't rely on the phone bar, but after I hit the underlying tree there, Brains, you know, I sort of had little pieces all over my roof.
Okay, but when you study that network, that's what we're talking about. It's a simple auto transformer. It's a the center tap goes on to the tap on this transformer-like thing. And it doesn't have a primary and a secondary. It's a tapped primary. And you properly resonate it, and it's going to do most of the impedance step-up that we want, and the antenna tuner does the rest. I can see Mel sitting there saying, gee, I've got the resources to do that too. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is
K2KEY.
Well, honestly, the article I think I told Barry about, the company makes the phase harness and all, K3LR system. And in fact, I had the article, I think I saw it not too long ago. He had a unique thing he put up in the top of the tower, a boom. And then the boom extends over either side of the tower using as a center pivot. And he said he's got these two inverted hanging down from it with a spreader on the bottom of each inverted V. And Vic, he rotates it. He was able to rotate this whole thing. Not by remote. He does it by the Armstrong method. He goes out and he's able to pull his whole business around because it's staked out, you know, tied down the end, the ground point. But the idea is they'll set it up to a person at times to work Europe with it, other times he worked in Asia or whatever on 75, 80 meters. So that's basically his setup there and all, Dick. It was, the pictures I saw of it was quite impressive, but not a complicated. The whole thing is your senses for the power took over.
Yeah, what I like about this is that I know for a fact the center of the dipole is where the strongest magnetic field exists. The fact that that part is kind of an inverted V, vertically polarized, further away from the tower means that you go one step further to eliminate tower obstruction, interference, call it what you like, detuning effects, and only the tips of the dipole are coming back, in my case, to the tower, up high and then down quite a bit lower. And so that's just adding some capacitance, which just, again, changes the tuning a little bit. I see this as a an antenna with a lot of performance and pure, or this is a modified vertical dipole. I'm sitting here getting very convinced that that whole concept of an antenna on HF band has not been given anywhere near the amount of play it deserves. I think that antenna has got a lot going for it, and just people can't envision the way it works. They can't quite envision the fact that a vertically polarized signal reflecting off the ground, you know, a mile out in front of your antenna, does not, for the most part, experience phase inversion on reflection. Therefore, it is capable of giving you reasonably high elevation phase center, very low angle of radiation. Gotta be a DX antenna's dream. Your phase center is close to as high up as you can get with that particular polarization. The only thing it doesn't have is a polarization adaptability, but I don't think you really need that much when you've got that low an angle of radiation. Until the signal is absolutely purely cross-polarized, pure horizontal into this antenna, I think it's not going to have any nulls out there. I think an awful lot of the QSB fading will not occur with this antenna. That's my belief. I'm sitting here getting excited about thinking about building it. Oh, it's going to take 6 months, but still. I haven't touched an HF frequency in decades, and there's just enough thinking out of the box of this one to drive me back to do a little bit of HF performance.
I just want to make a quick comment on this.
Yeah, go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I just want to mention that you know, people who are thinking of making this shouldn't consider the 2 dB or whatever gain you're going to get out of this. That's really not the big thing. When you go to a second element, the big thing is the front-to-back ratio, and that's where you eliminate all that static and other stations. You know, that's the big thing. The gain is kind of negligible, really.
Yeah, but think about something else, Barry. Let's assume that I built three of these in three directions, every 120 degrees, and one of those directions is the driven element, and I'm going to aim that to the northeast, to my buddies in Europe, assuming I had some buddies in Europe. Now, by way of the other two elements, 120 degrees apart, both acting as a reflector, I'm not doing it for gain reasons, but by properly electronically tuning those, I think you can steer a null across a substantial percentage of the back hemisphere of this antenna. So, if there happens to be some very strong QR Mary coming from the, when I'm aimed to the northeast, and I create a null to the southwest, that's great. And I'm going to be using the two parasitic elements that are displaced by 120 degrees. However, by slightly phasing those, I think that that null can be steered more clockwise and more counterclockwise, top view. I think you see where I'm going here on this one, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay. I think one of the biggest advantages I noticed about this antenna so far that I've been experimenting with it is that when you work in the European, most of your interference is coming from in close. It's coming from the United States, it's coming from South America, and that's where the antenna, because it's vertically polarized, seems to perform much worse. And that's a big plus, actually.
So you're telling me the close-in guys, because of Faraday rotation, because of Nevis effects and whatever, the close-in guys are de-emphasized by this antenna, and its beautiful low angle of radiation is strongly emphasizing delta X-rays, what I think you're telling me. Go ahead.
Yeah, almost without exception. I can't remember a time when that wasn't true. The only anomaly I ran into was about an hour before sundown. I find that on the DS station, the ones that are out 6,000 miles or more, I find